Welcome to Middle School Matters podcast number 691. The parents know. We're going to have some jokes for you. We're going to have some resources. We got all kinds of things for your classroom this week. So, without further ado, here's the wonderful, the magnanimous, the Mr. Troy Patterson.
All right. Welcome back to the show. I am Troy Patterson, and with me is the world's greatest co-show host, Mr. Sean McGurr. Hey, Sean.
Well, hello there. How are you?
I'm doing, you know, kind of okay. I took a job at the keyboard factory, and I got fired yesterday.
You did?
Yeah, I wasn't putting in enough shifts.
I got you. Mm-hmm. I got you. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I do say, I think I'm applying for a job in the moisturizer industry, though.
Moisturizer?
Yeah, I have to apply daily.
I got you. Yes. And these days, especially right now, more than that.
Got a birthday card the other day, opened it up, and a load of rice fell out.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it was from Uncle Ben.
Ah, very generous of him.
Did you hear about the incredibly average philosopher?
Average philosopher? No.
Yes. His name is Mediocrates.
I got you. Very Greek.
You know, I think that if you were going to be a rapper, we would call you MC Spice.
Really?
Yeah, because that way you could say, stop, hammer time.
Time. Yes. Time. Yeah, T-H-Y-M-E-I. Yeah.
Hey, why are robots never afraid?
Robots never, I don't know. Why are three laws or something like that? Why are robots never afraid?
They have nerves of steel.
Oh, yes. Shocking.
Yeah. a friend of mine texted me that they saw a wolf on the way to work.
Really?
Yeah. I wondered, how did they know the wolf was on its way to work?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Quick quiz for you.
And a lamb.
You can shave 25 times a day and still have a beard.
Oh, that's me. That's me. Right here. That's me.
It's a barber.
Oh, I got you.
Oh, I accidentally ran into a man who once sold me an antique globe.
Did it hurt?
It's a small world.
I got you. Mm-hmm.
And did you hear the guy who tied his spaghetti together?
Tied his spaghetti together? You know, it's interesting. Nobody ever calls it spaghetto. It's always plural, spaghetti. Anyways, that's side note. Tell me about this spaghetti tying gentleman.
He ended up skipping dinner. Sean is still thinking about that one. Okay, so let's finish out with, I did try to take some high-resolution photos of local farmland the other day. They all turned out a bit grainy.
I got you. Yep.
Okay.
No, barley.
All right. Rye. Sean was not impressed this week, so we'll switch to something that I know Sean will be impressed by.
Oh.
This is part two.
It is.
Part two of data science in education. Okay. And I think you're going to really like this one. And this is revolving around the difficulty of designing relevant and engaging data science lessons. So here, without further ado, is the wonderful Mr. Dave Bidlowski and the Middle School Science Minute.
Hi, this is Dave Bidlowski of K12Science.net, and this is your K-12 Science Podcast. This is the second in a three-part series on data science education, and it's based on an article taken from The Science Teacher, a publication of the National Science Teaching Association, and it's the November-December 2025 issue. And the article is entitled, Finding Your Way into Data Science Education as a Science Teacher, written by Matthias Fischer, Cody Pritchard, Zen Yu, and Joshua Rosenberg. In the first podcast, we looked at the first of three challenges that occur in data science education. The first challenge is the lack of training to teach data science. In this podcast, we'll look at the difficulty of designing relevant and engaging data science lessons. Teachers may wonder how their lessons can be relevant and engaging to their students. And here are three ideas about different ways to achieve this. Number one, avoid making assumptions about your students' interest. Don't be afraid to ask them directly. Interest surveys are helpful to collect data on common interests. Secondly, find data related to students' interests and community. See if you or your students can collect data related to questions emerging from their interests, their community. The aforementioned open understanding of the nature of data will help your students to understand that data can be collected on anything. And third, teach abstract concepts with concrete examples. If you want to teach abstract concepts like outliers, measures of center, and different visualizations, then using data from your classroom or school is helpful. While this may not always seem interesting, it is concrete and easy to discuss and can eventually lead to more abstract thinking. This advice once again highlights the importance of using contexts that capture the student's interest. Research tells us that this can only be achieved if teachers consider and incorporate cultural and socio-political dimensions of their lessons. Therefore, selecting a topic that's relevant to students at their stage of life and within their communities is essential. For example, those teaching about ecosystem processes can choose a topic and select data from or about their local ecosystem, such as water quality or biodiversity data. Those teaching about chemistry could choose local water quality and corresponding data. And those teaching the physical sciences could use examples related to climate science and local energy production and consumption. Another example can be seen in an activity explained by one of the authors. His students collected data on college tuition over the past 15 years for colleges that they were interested in attending someday. Using scatter plots and linear regression models, students predicted the cost of tuition a few years from now and when they expect to be in college. However, it's important to keep in mind that while this lesson might have been relevant to the author's students, it may not be relevant to other groups of students. Ultimately, it all comes down to knowing your students and allowing them to select topics that interest them. A key aspect of teaching data science is providing students with opportunities to analyze and interpret data visualizations. There are several resources available to teachers for engaging students in this process. The New York Times, in collaboration with the Learning Network, features a What's Going On in This Graph resource with hundreds of data visualizations and specific questions to engage students in this process daily. The authors also acknowledge the challenge of finding meaningful topics with sufficient data that allow learning-specific skills. One option is to use free online lessons. Some of these lessons are specifically designed to capture common interests. For example, coral bleaching and climate change by Data Nuggets. Other options are websites that offer free data sets. Lastly, teachers can create their own data set, for example, by using ChatGPT. In our next podcast, the third of the three-part series, we'll look at the third challenge, teaching data science without technological resources. And this has been your K-12 Science Podcast.
All right. How was your week this week there, Sean?
Well, it was a busy week. We had conference is this week.
You said you had conferences.
Yeah, and we did ourselves. We gave ourselves a gift. It's true. On Fridays we do student success team meetings. Right, and the Friday afternoon is supposed to be, you know, we bring in a parent, we bring in the kid, and we talk about, all right, so we're bringing you in because your kid is in serious jeopardy of failing, and you know there's some things we need to turn around here to make sure your kid is successful. But we're allowed to do those on our prep beforehand.
Yes.
And if we do them all on our prep beforehand, we can take Friday afternoon off.
And so that's nice.
I had Friday afternoon to do things I needed to get done for myself. And so I did. I got some stuff done in my classroom, and I said, that's enough of that. And then we left. But we also had conferences on Thursday night. It was drop-in conferences. Yes. And we didn't have very many people, largely because it was 13 degrees below zero wind chill. And we were in the process of about an inch and a half to 2 inches of snow coming down rather frequently.
Yeah.
And so I did see five or six parents, and about 2/3 of that number were parents of students I don't have. They're just coming to come in and let me know that, you know, hey, this is what my kid is doing now, and they're catching up. And it was great. I loved it. You want to see the kids that are you need to see and the parents you need to see. And I had a chance. I had one of those did come in, and I had a serious conversation with them saying, you know, this is what your kid needs, and this is not doing. It's not cutting it. He's not getting what he needs to do. He's not doing what he needs to do to get everything he can out of what he needs to learn. And grandpa and mom are really, really supportive. We'll see how that goes. Right, because
yeah,
we're people.
So you don't your school doesn't schedule parent conferences except for the student success meetings. Is that correct?
And we have to schedule those ourselves. But yes, otherwise it's usually just drop in for conferences. We have done it in the past where we did do scheduled, you know, set up and schedule a time. We have done it that way. It's very elementary. And then parents complain, you're not going to get 110 parents in for the amount of time that we have to do conferences if 110 parents want to come in and see you. So there's never enough slots. So it's right. Not practical at the middle level. The other thing is that when during COVID, it was the only way to do it, right? You had different Google Meet rooms for different parents. So you were constantly running from one one Google Meet room to the next Google room to the next Google room. And that was rather like running sprints at a marathon. And then in the fall, we do a shotgun method where we're all in the gym and people come in and we sit as a team and we sit down and go, hey, let's talk about your kid together, you know, as a team. Because if they're not being successful in one area, there's a really good chance that they're not in others. And if they are, we need to figure out why they're so successful here and not there. What are the things that we can do to support and make this work? So for conferences for us, we do it in a variety of different ways. You have to remember that I'm in a 99-year-old high school. And so things are very, very designed and built for high school. They are not built, not conducive to a middle school.
I just wondered, and how much time do you generally spend? Because there's a lot of different ways to do conferences, right?
Yes.
How much time do you spend, or do you kind of schedule for drop-in parent conferences, or do you just do kind of, if there's somebody waiting, you kind of hurry it up, but if there's nobody waiting, you just keep talking?
Well, given the nature of the conferences this year, and since it was more of a catch-up situation, we talked until we saw somebody hang around the door. And then as soon as we saw somebody hang around the door, I was like, oh, well, let them have you. And they left, and I talked to the next person, which more often than not happened to be the same type of conversation that I just finished, which is fine. I love catching up with the kids and the parents, finding out what they're doing.
Yeah. How long do you think is ideal for parent conferences?
Usually we can say everything we need to say in about 10 minutes. And It depends on the teacher, right? Like, I try to keep it very businesslike, and I try to keep it very non-personal, right? So it's a, here's the deal. This is what's going on. Let's talk about strategies to make it better. Now, there are other parents and teachers in particular who like to talk, and they think that this should be a full full diagnostic, and let's go back into the child's history and talk about all kinds of things. I don't think that's the, for me, it doesn't work because I have other parents that want this time too. So I don't do it that way. I keep it very businesslike. Others are very, very, very narrative based and want to talk. Yeah. And that's something that I think they should set up and do separate. You know, talk about the things. And if you need to talk more, then set up a time to talk more, because there are other folks that need that time too.
As you say, the balance here is this your only opportunity to establish those relationships? Do you have a relationship with the parents? Is this going to be a relationship? Is this going to start a relationship? Or is this going to be, you're going to talk to them now and then you're going to talk to them in spring conferences?
Right? Yeah. And
not really going to have a relationship. So
we ran across that very issue when we did student led conferencing for the first time about 20 years ago. And parents said, no, this is about me building a relationship with you. This is not about me talking about kids' grades and my relationship with my kid, which we're like, why aren't we here for the kid? Because it's the kid's performance and not my performance that's the big factor here. But that was the thing that stopped us from doing student-led conferencing, was because so many parents said, no, I want to get to know the teacher. Now, it's different. It's also different on my end, because a lot of the parents that walk in, I had them.
So they know you.
Right. It's not like we have to start building a relationship. I've got one. They're in my classroom. So maybe that's another reason why I can cut the business and just,
yeah,
relationship's already there. Yeah.
And then you mentioned student-led conferences as well. And that's another way of doing conferences. And how much time did you schedule for students to do the student-led conferences?
Well, we would schedule 3 or 4 conferences in a room at a time. And then the teacher would just go and facilitate the conferences, right? And they were available in the room. So you had 3 rooms or 2 rooms with 3 to 5 conferences going on at a time. And you could get through everybody that way.
And
it,
did it take
to do it.
Yeah. So, and was the idea the kids did one student conference that kind of was holistic of all of their classes, or did they repeat this per class?
No, this is, so they came in as a team, right? We're a team.
Yes.
So right. They picked the artifacts that were the best examples of their work across the team. And then we gave them a script, because 7th graders need scripts. So we gave them a script and they proceeded to work through the script. And, you know, this is math, this is science, this is language art, this is social studies. And I was an encore teacher at the time attached to a team. And so I could just go in and I could facilitate the meetings with not having to worry about, like, you know, make sure you have an artifact from your encore teacher in here. You know, let's worry about the core. And then if they want to talk about encore, then they go talk to Mr. McGurr, which they didn't have a lot. And they don't. Usually if I, at that stage of the game, as an encore teacher, I only talk to parents who weren't happy. I didn't get to talk to the ones who were happy. It's like, wait a minute. How come you guys get all the good news? I get all the bad news. It's just the nature of the beast at the way we were doing it at the time. But no, the kids had to go through and they had to justify their performance in each class. And we had it in sections, math, science, social studies, language arts.
And did the kids practice their, you said you gave them a script. Did you do other training or practicing with the kids in before the conferences?
I don't remember us doing that. You have to remember this was a very long time ago.
I know.
I don't remember us doing that, but I hope we did if we didn't. And For some, it was really stressful. But for others, it wasn't, because they were like, take a look at this. See, this is what I got. And this is what I'm doing here. And I really like this about this assignment. It's kind of what I like about the Michigan History Day Project is the last question that the judges usually ask is, tell me one thing you learned by doing this. And it gets lit up and they're like, oh, I learned this. Right. And it's because it adds that relevance piece to it. Yeah.
Okay. Because I know as a principal, we did student-led conferences, and it was always mixed results. We always kind of felt it, you know.
I'd never heard portfolio review referred to as a student-led conference.
You've never heard portfolio review?
Yeah, when you go in to review your portfolio with your principal.
Yes.
As a student-led conference.
No, I mean that's cute, but we as a school, see, one of the things that, you know, you make a reference here, but for me, this is kind of a fundamental difference that I sometimes have trouble elucidating, I think, is as a principal, I was just part of the school. So it was, we had different roles, sure, and I had a role, but I was just part of the school. And so we did stuff together. It wasn't like me doing stuff. It was we doing stuff. And my goal was to really live that, not just say that, because I know a lot of people say it's we, and then they don't act like it's we. They act
right.
Like it's,
yes.
They act like it's, we're going to do this, and this is what I have determined and told you are going to do. That wasn't my MO. And, I hope that if you talk to any teachers that that I worked with, they would agree that that wasn't my MO. We worked together. I mean, there were certainly times when the district said, thou shalt, and we had to do that. But it's like how we did it. I always tried to make it how us and how we did that. So it's like, yeah, we got to do this, guys. How are we gonna do it? How are we gonna make this work within what we know works with kids? So,
and that's key, because they understand the kids more, you know, their kids better than somebody from outside the building just saying something. And buildings within yours is a really, really big district, and so you had a variety of kids, even from one side of the city to the other.
Oh yeah, very much so.
Yeah, I was, of course, making. I was making a joke about the portfolio process.
Yes.
In general. But I think one of the things that we learned from doing student-led portfolios or student-led conferencing was that the students had to take ownership of their work. And it no longer became this disconnect of picking and choosing assignments to do or not to do. Because then they had to justify why they chose not to do it to someone who didn't accept it.
A big part of the student-led conferences was really getting kids to be reflective and put together a portfolio, like a decent portfolio, instead of just grabbing random assignments. And it also led to a lot of discussion amongst the teachers about getting the kids to understand that we weren't just doing random assignments every week, that there was a flow and we were building to something, and having kids reflect on, okay, why are we doing this and how does this fit in with where we want to end up? So yeah, that was, and that was, it always seemed like a lot of work. The teachers always said it's like a lot of work. Because it's, in theory, the kids are doing a ton of work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, a lot of the teachers were doing a lot of work. So it was kind of a stressor. So, okay, I just wondered. And then you mentioned remote. Is remote an option for parent conferences now or for you or no? I mean, you had drop-in, but was there also a option to connect remotely?
When we schedule them, yes. But even then, half of them, maybe a third, let's say a third, just ghosted you. And they would set it up, and then I think either some, I'm sure, just simply forgot, right? Because it's not part of their weekly routine. And then there are others that were like, I set it up, you know, and then they would do the whole, my technology doesn't. And it's like, yeah, wait a minute. Your technology worked to set it up. Your technology would work to do it. So, yeah, I don't know. Although I will say this, it made for really convenient bathroom breaks. Because then you could take one, and you're like, they didn't show. Yeah. So I got 5 minutes. I'm hitting the bathroom.
Yeah. I just wondered because one of the things I think COVID did was normalize remote connections and remote conferencing kind of thing. Before COVID, I still remember that there was a couple of times when I was working in Dearborn. Dearborn is a large city, and it could take 15, 20 minutes to go from where I was to a school on the other side of the city, right? And there have been a couple of times where I was like, can I just video conference you? Because it was like another director or principal. And I knew we needed to have a 5 to 10 minute conversation.
Right.
And I knew the email was not going to be the way to do this. And phone calls could kind of do it, but it'd be way better because I had something to show them or demonstrate or something. And I was like, can we just do a video conference? No, 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 no. So I'd drive the 20 minutes, show them how to do something for 10 minutes. They'd be, oh, okay, great, 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 great. And then I'd drive the 20 minutes back to work. Not exactly the most efficient path. And then after COVID hit and everybody had to get comfortable with video conferencing, it kind of became, can we just do a video conference real quick? It's like, yes. So that was one thing that changed. And I think in general, a lot of parents also couldn't attend parent conferences because they were working or, you know, they had other things. It was hard for them to get in. And there was times when could at least connect up with them and say, oh, hi, hey, and have a little conference. So just wondered how that played out for you, because I know a lot of schools around the country are, I know that I've talked to some teachers out west that they have one conference is in the building and one day of conferencing is remote. So,
oh, okay.
You know.
Yeah.
All right. And how many conferences do you have a year? We're doing conferences.
We do a conference in the fall, 2 weeks after the first report card. And then we used to do it after the third report card, but discovered that's just way too late for kids who are uber failing. And there's no possible way for them to make up enough grades to be successful. Yeah. So we switched it to after the second quarter grades were done. And then they have third quarter to get it fixed. And again, if you don't have it fixed after third quarter, there's nothing anybody can do for you. By that token, I should also mention our district psychologist has stated that no one will fail.
Okay.
So this is performance art, not actual work. I mean, effective things that, and the parents know it. They know the kid's not going to fail. I don't. So, yeah, it's performance art.
Okay, and you're on quarters, so you do quarters as well.
We do quarters, and then we get a dollar at the end of the year.
Because I know that there's a lot of schools that do semesters. There's a lot that do trimesters. There's away they go. So you have four report cards a year.
I do. The high school has more than that. They're on 6 weeks. And
do they do progress reports or full report cards?
They do report cards. And so because they do report cards, they don't have to do progress reports. We have to do progress reports for the first, second, and third quarters. Obviously, fourth quarter, it's not progress anymore. It's pre-op.
I like that one. Because I know we did... We had a variety of ways of doing report cards, and generally, we talked a lot about report cards as a district, how many we were doing, and all of that, and we ended up, trying to break it down more, and making it progress reports instead of report cards. And because I think we had, at one point we had report cards every 6 weeks. And the discussion was, it's just a lot. It's not like it wasn't viewed as productive because, in middle school, sometimes 6 weeks, there wasn't a lot of change in 6 weeks. So...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think my argument for going to 6 weeks is the kids can't think that far out.
Yeah.
And so I know there's progress reports at 5 weeks, but it's not important, right? Because it's a progress report. It doesn't carry the same weight. Whereas if it was a grade that goes on a report card that gets averaged into the total, that carries a little more weight. And then it's in front of the kids all the time. There's positives and negatives. You could go either way on it. I think it largely depends on what the culture is in your district and with your kids.
Yes, I agree.
100% makes a difference as to which way you go on that. So,
yeah. All right. Let's wander over to the social web and take a look at what's going on there.
Oh, social web. Well, this one is the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary. At OED, and it says, the OED hashtag word of the day. I thought this was pretty decent. Maybe it's like some teachers. Teachers are exactly like this word sometimes, right?
Okay.
And this is mirabiliary. Say that three times fast.
I'm glad you do words of the day and not me.
Well, this one is a good one. It's a person who deals in marvels, a collector of marvelous things, which is sometimes the filing cabinets of that teacher that's been teaching for 20 plus years. Right? Yes, since it's Oxford, it will have a funny spelling of something sometimes. Eric Kurtz has a new gem, EduGem. He's got several, but I picked this one. This EduGem is Educational Map Maker. Create a data-rich interactive educational map for any topic with a custom-generated CSV file for Google My Maps. And I have a link for you in the show notes. So you can do that. Mm-hmm. Keep Indiana Learning. By the way, you should be able to take that gem and make it your own. So once you get it, I believe he forces you to get a copy of it. Put it in your own Gemini.
So with EduGems, normally you can either use it or you can copy it. So there'll be two links on these. Sorry, I don't mean to step on your toes here, but with the EduGems, there's two links. One to just use it, so you can use it and try it out, and then the one link is going to be to copy it and make it your own. So I did some training on Gemini this past week. So
nice. Okay. I'd run into it where I went to his website and I had one link And then sometimes it was pulled down and sometimes it was just use. So yeah. It was just me being a bad internet navigator.
Yeah, but if you go over to EduGems, you get the choice. So.
Got it.
Sorry.
No worries. Keep Indiana learning. Starting off with a keynote from a teacher, astronaut Joe Acaba. Make students uncomfortable in a good way. That's the quote. And I think that's interesting because we're going to talk later this week. I ran across an article from the Freeman talking about AI and inequality. And mm-hmm. one of the key pieces of that was we aren't making students uncomfortable while they're learning. And so as a result, we're not seeing the retention of knowledge. We're seeing it as them dipping into a jar or a tub of butter and slathering it over something. And then not consuming it and storing it, just passing it on and going to the next thing to slather onto the next thing. That's the imagery is my own. It wasn't in the article. We'll talk more when we get there.
Yeah.
Cause you saw it a little different than I did. MiddleWeb, review has posted a review called An Innovative Approach to Grammar Instruction. It's a book called Not Your Granny's Grammar. And it's more than just a set of grammar lessons. It's an invitation to reimagine grammar instruction as lively, meaningful, and integrated with student writing. And I know that there are some districts that are going to a canned program where you stand up, you do this, you stand up, you do that, and then it's everything is scripted. And I think in doing that, you lose the art of curriculum instruction and you lose the creativity that teachers bring to instruction. And this is, I think, a product of somebody's creativity saying, I don't like the way it's going. I want to do it and reimagine the way it's done. So it's about $40 on Amazon. In fact, I think it's exactly $40 on Amazon. So this is not a cheap tome. But if you're looking for something to kind of jog or jostle or disrupt your grammar instruction, this might be yours. There's a link in the show notes to the review. But I will tell you this, MiddleWeb does select really good stuff for their reviews. And if you're on their Substack, you can pay for their Substack, which will get you even more stuff on each one of the things that they do and they review.
Okay.
I put a picture in with this one so that Troy could actually see world famous. Maybe he's like an Uber listener. To our show. He's been around with us for a very, very long time.
He has.
Yeah, this is Ron King. And he posted, Happy Blue Friday. Let's get another Lombardi trophy. And, of course, he's rooting for the Seahawks in the Super Bowl this year.
Yep.
I don't know. I didn't ask Troy who he was rooting for this year. But he's close.
Rooting for the Lions.
There you go. All right. That also would be a Blue Friday. Good answer. Yeah, next year. Next year's our year.
Next year.
Yep. And then MiddleWeb posted, sure. If you're a Lions fan, you know. Next year is this perennial thing that manana, manana, manana. MiddleWeb posted another one on media literacy. What if every teacher taught media literacy? Media literacy author and consultant Frank Baker shares ideas for working with media literacy into lessons across the curriculum, which, of course, is a middle school hallmark, interdisciplinary lesson design. And you can find a link to that article and his ideas over on the show notes. And that's what I have for you from the social web this week.
Okay. Let's see. One of the things that I came across this week and I thought was fun was an assignment from... from as an assignment from an eighth grade teacher, an eighth grade English teacher, Michelle Haken, who teaches at Rye Middle School in New York. And it is kind of, it's interesting, and it led to the uncovering of another resource as well. But this one is turn movie magic into literary analysis with Anatomy of a Scene. So What it is the New York Times has a resource called Anatomy of a Scene. And it's neat because it's like the director's talking about a scene. And they have a whole bunch of them. They have something from Knives Out, which I just watched a couple of weeks ago. And it's called Wake Up Dead Man, Anatomy of a Scene. And it's the director talking about the scene, and they play the scene. And many of these are like, I think they're all under 5 minutes. So a lot of them are like 2 minutes or something, 2 to 3 minutes. But they show the scene, and they show the director talking about the scene and what they did and why they did it. So that part, I think, can be very useful for a variety of things, especially in English. But then she takes the concept, and she has the students work out and kind of play the role of director. Like, what is the scene from a graphic novel or a book or something like that? And they create their own. She uses window notes, which I think is kind of related to Frère models. And then there's a template that she has as well, which is, hi, my name is, I'm going to be talking about the graphic novel. The book is mainly about, today I want to talk about the scene. The scene appears, or at this point in the novel, the details you see, purpose of the scene, what stands out the most, and the sequence shows the character, and what the scene really is about is blah, blah, blah. So I think it's a neat structure, and I think it's a different way for kids to talk about and think about art and novels and stories and lots of things. So it's pretty cool. And I like the resource as well, because you can hear directors talking about like why they did this. And again, for example, I watched the Wake Up Dead Man, which is from the latest Knives Out movie. And it is a scene that occurs kind of in the middle of the movie, but it was the first thing that the director shot, and he explains why it was the first thing that he shot. So did you see the latest Knives Out movie? Did you watch that one?
I'll be very honest. I have not seen a movie since Christmas break. I've not seen the latest one. I haven't seen all three. I know about them. I haven't even seen the latest episode of Tehran, which just dropped on Friday.
Okay. I just wondered.
I will get to it, though. But so, I love this idea about breaking down scenes and seeing it from that, because the kids, this is going to do so much for language. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they even have like Frankenstein from the Guillermo del Toro. And he narrates a sequence from the film starring Oscar Isaac. That one is 4 minutes and 35 seconds. But there's a lot of them. And they give you a transcript as well. And so, you know, you can look through it, but I think there's real power in listening to the directors talk about what they did, why they did, how they did it, kind of thing. So there's quite a few of them. I think it's very awesome. So so it'd be great for English teachers, obviously, if you teach anything with video production, or even, you know, getting kids to create their own videos to show that they understand something can be powerful. All right. I also sent this along to Sean this week.
Yes.
And because I thought it was neat, and it's a very steampunky look.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Applause Meter. And it's one of those, there's other ones out there, but it's one of those listen to the sound in the room kind of thing. As it does, it tells you how loud things are in the room. And there's a little nice little arrow that goes back and forth. So you can monitor the noise level in the classroom. So I know long ago we used to have a physical device that was like a stoplight.
Yep. And you could adjust it.
And you could adjust it, right?
Yep.
So, all right. Let's see here. I also have from our buddy Tony Vincent. I don't know Tony Vincent, but he has a Padlet set up. And I got to tell you, the first thing I thought of when I saw this was, ooh, I could do this as an H5P board.
Yeah, that's true. It looks just like
But he's got a Padlet set up, which I think is interesting. It has different columns. And it is... and then each one of the columns gives you a quick idea of something you can do. They're all free, no login, browser-based, and low prep. The columns include physical. So it has some physical break things, some games, brain break yoga. Dance and shake. There's a lot of them there. There's cognitive, take a cognitive break. There's relaxing, which is pretty self-explanatory, kind of relaxing. There's social, there's humor, there's sensory, and there's creativity. So you can... click on them to get them to open up. I would do this as, I think I would do this as a H5P board, but hey. And then do note that some of these are going to open in a new tab. So... I guess I could have done the open a joke. Maybe we'll use these for next week. But it's a basic link board. But if you're looking for some ideas, it's a nice spot to bookmark and find out what's available, and just kind of, especially if you need quick things. All right, you sent along an article on AI, and you made reference to it earlier.
I did.
So let's talk a little bit about this. This is from, and I have forgotten the author's name. Stephen Weiss.
It is.
Weiss.
At the bottom, yep.
Sorry.
Yep, Stephen Weiss. He writes for The Freeman, not your typical AI-focused think tank.
No.
But I thought this was interesting. And I asked a couple people to give me their feedback on it, and I asked Troy to take a look at it. And then I didn't give him time to read it. I just started peppering
I just questions. So you got stream of consciousness is what you got from me. So
yeah. So I now that he's kind of had a chance to look at it. So what's your take on this? And your takeaway I think is going to be different than mine, and it's going to be different than some of the other people I looked at or talked to about it. But so first of all, the premise is the quote at the very beginning. Article opens with you may have heard the recent. Still not yet peer-reviewed, studied MIT, that showed that students using LLMs, such as ChatGPT, to perform writing tasks demonstrated reduced brain activity and showed little retention of the text that was created as a result. I didn't know there was an MIT study until I saw this.
In the study, so there's a couple of things. Obviously, there's a lot of teachers who are concerned about kids using AI and not doing the hard work of learning, right? Just skipping through.
Yep.
And one teacher, I'm sure more than one, but one teacher I know of has expressed it as kids don't care about learning, they just care about getting grades. And AI helps them get grades without having to learn.
And sometimes I think that first sentence was just a little too long.
A little too long.
Yeah. It's not that they don't care about grades. They just want to get it done. I think sometimes they just don't care about grades. And you're going to find that in any population. I'm just going for the joke.
Yes. So there are some... There's been quite a bit of the, if you don't do the thinking, then you're missing out. That's what education is supposed to be about. And I think that this kind of reiterates that. One of the things I try to be cognizant of, though, is to not just be the cranky old man that says, you know, back in my day, we had to do this. And I'm very aware that times change and things change. And I'm a big fan of the Pessimist Archive, where they document how many things were going to kill society and ruin society and just destroy society. And even going back far enough, into, you know, Gutenberg and the development of books. And there was big pushback against books because once you had a book, you didn't have to know anything. You could look it up whenever you want, right? Mm-hmm. And now we're like, kids aren't reading books anymore. Also back in the Gutenberg time, it was like, well, kids won't have to learn stories. They won't have to learn how to tell a good story. They won't have to learn how to, you know, the entertainment part. They're going to lose a lot. And now we're kind of like 180 degrees of that. It's like kids need to learn, read books. They need to learn. And we're kind of going back to storytelling in some ways. So the other thing that I pointed out to Sean that I think he kind of said, huh, interesting, which is Sean's way of saying, I don't necessarily agree with that. Because one of the things that, you know, he says in the article that Stephen Weiss says is like, for me, it works. Because it helps me do more, because I have a background, I know things already, I'm at a different point in my life. And that's one of the things that always strikes me, because it's like, generally people don't use things more than once. So use them on a regular basis. If it's... And I'm really struggling with a way to say this correctly, but if they don't think that it's doing them some good. Because the flip side of this is, like, everybody knows we should exercise more and eat less, but, like, that's hard to do, right? Most people don't do that. We know that we should do certain things, and yet we don't. But there's just a little bit of the, you know, students need to do the thinking, but I don't, kind of thing in there. It's not a big part. It just was part of my first read through. So I wanted to share that. But I do think that I think it's problematic if we don't teach kids how to think, because I think critical thinking is crucial. And in order for critical thinking to work, you've got to know how to think critically. So what did you come away with this one on?
Yeah, so there was that section, right, where there's the, you know, the, where he was going after the new technology piece, and that didn't surprise me much at all, right? But what I took away from it was the bottom, and the bottom half was talking, and all the rest of it was setting up for this, I think, when he says, when we strive, we thrive. He's talking about stealing the struggle from the learner, and in struggling and wrestling with ideas is when we come away with that permanence in the memory, but also has an emotional meaning to us because we struggled with it and we can remember that, and it's something that helps us with our recall in that. I think of the experiences that folks had in university, right? What is that big magnum opus that they made? Right. Then they had to struggle with it and learn things in order to produce that product. You know, that's something that lasts with them forever. There's all those big major assignments in classes. Those are the things where you used what you learned to develop and produce something. You step back and go, I learned from that experience. Now I can draw on that to do something here in the future that I need it for. And I think that part in the second half is where he focuses on that part of it. And I think that's part of that leveraging factor. We talked about the Hale system, right, for AI. And I think that's where the leverage part comes in. It's not just about using it for the shortest and quickest answer. It's about how do you use it to develop and produce something meaningful that attaches that knowledge in your head somewhere so that you can pull it out and use that in another situation, adapted to a need that you have in the moment to solve a problem now. I showed it to a person who, our tech coach, who also does a drum, not camp, but a drum corps team. Mm-hmm. And I watched him as he was grabbing wholesale paragraphs out of it and sharing it with his drum line and sharing it with the drum line coaches, his fellow coaches, saying, you know, let's talk about this. You know, yeah. I think this is the piece our core is missing when it comes to understanding and relying on practice and relying on the ability to function and do, right? It's one thing to mail it in. It's another thing to be able to pick it up and perform on notice. And he says we lose something when we don't have that ability to do that. And I think we do lose something in that respect.
And he does say the problem is not AI tools in and of themselves. It is that right. They remove the challenge and duration of educational assignments. We must find a way to challenge students continually to encourage information retention and critical thinking and to demonstrate the benefits to individuals and society of subject mastery.
Yeah. So,
I also think that he also says the pandemic shift, that's where, like, you know, kids lost a half grade to two grades to whatever. But the pandemic shift will be mild compared to what we may soon see from the ChatGPT content generation. And I think that's an interesting thing to think about as well.
Yeah, in his article, he's talking about how there's going to be a dichotomy between those who run to AI for answers each and every time, and those who have the ability to critically think about what AI is feeding them and apply it as a fine-tuned tool, as opposed to those who just drop and use it wholesale without thinking about it.
Right.
Which, so when I made Danu, that resource room helper, and I got the feedback from the special ed kid who tested it for me and says, I don't like it. So, well, why don't you like it? Well, it doesn't give me the answer. Yeah, that's true. It doesn't give you the answer, okay, but it helps you think it through to get to the answer. Do you still use it? Yeah, I still use it. Okay. Use it, but you don't like it. Yes. Simply because it doesn't give me the easy answer. No. Oh, okay. I'm all right with that.
All right.
Yeah. So this article popped up in my feed this week and it made me stop and think.
Yeah. And it is an interesting article. I don't disagree. So, all right. Larry Furlazzo's grandson is going to be a teacher.
Wow.
And he shares some tips with his grandson about engagement. And if you're familiar with Larry Furlazzo, these are right in his wheelhouse. So I'll just link to it and you can go over there and check that out. If you want to head over and check out Sean, Sean is doing a conference.
Yeah, if you want to, sometimes when we go to conferences, you know, we encourage you guys to come and talk to us. I am doing a conference. I got accepted to present at Gen AI Conference at Eastern Michigan University on March 16th. I put a link in the show notes. Registration is free, is limited, but it is free. And it's open to university students, teachers, administrators, anybody interested in all different kinds of aspects of AI.
Okay. And of course, if you want to continue learning about AI and other stuff, please keep listening to the show and encourage your other teachers that you know, teammates at Teacher Down the Hall to listen as well. We would love it if you'd head over to the podcast catcher of your choice. Give us a 5-star rating. Tell us why Sean is the world's greatest co-show host. And of course, you can get notes of everything that we've talked about and links over at middleschoolmatters.com. With that, this has been Middle School Matters for middle school educators who care. All opinions expressed on this podcast are exclusively the opinions of the host and guests and not indicative of any employer.